Thank you very much. I thought both presentations before mine were very enlightening in many ways, but I have to say that I disagree with the idea, to put this up front, that mosquitoes of all animals should have the same rights as we, especially, I think, in this particular part of the world. That's a very contentious message that you're sending. Of course, I understand that that's not necessarily your view. I would like to also perhaps facilitate the afternoon a little bit by taking a somewhat perhaps more applied approach to trying to understand the negotiation in intercultural contexts of culture and of history, but also emphasizing the institutional and the social context in which this actually takes place, and particularly in the museum context. And to facilitate that a little bit further, I will also show you a few photos of museums. Now, I think it's very important to understand that these processes of intercultural dialogue, as my predecessor has already emphasized, are often originate around conflicts, and that they are contested as well. That's something I would like to bring out in my presentation. I think this contestation is very important in order to clarify differences in views, in this particular case, of our shared history, or to some extent it may be experienced, presented and experienced as shared history, or also different views of our history in Europe. I would like to say very briefly that this is actually part of a larger research project which will lead to publication of a book in German first and then in English afterwards, which is provisionally entitled in English, Exhibiting Europe, Europeanization as Cultural Practice in the Museum. So our focus is very much about these negotiation processes in the museum context over our history, how to understand it and what kind of conclusions to draw from that for the future. And the starting assumption is that in these institutional cultural contexts like museums, for example, but there are others, of course, like film, theater, and all sorts of others that are imaginable and that you could look at, but in this particular case, in the context of museums, what we see is the participation of many different institutional and societal actors in this field and in these negotiation processes. So what I would like to talk about briefly is these different actors who are involved in negotiating our heritage and our history in the museum context. And then in the second part, I'll talk a little bit about different narratives of European history, which I see as evolving in the museum landscape, and particularly, but not only, in the bigger projects for history museums of the history of Europe or of European integration to be based, if they are effectively built in the end in Brussels. And in the very end of my presentation, I would like to link this to the larger debate about our collective memory as Europeans. I've borrowed this term without necessarily agreeing with it, because I think it's a little bit militaristic from a German sociologist, Klaus Leggeweh, who's recently published a book about the European memory battle or battlefield of European memory. And I think there are different ways in which a collective European memory is propagated for the future, which are conflicting to some extent, although I can see a consensus solution, which I would like to highlight at the end of my presentation, however, I personally think is very dangerous if we do decide to adopt it. Now, first of all, of course, in the cultural field, and more particularly in the museum field, we have a number of different state actors involved in this. What I think is very important to understand is, and that's the overall conclusion of this particular part of our project and our book, is that we should not limit ourselves to looking exclusively at the Brussels-based state actors of the European Union, the European Commission and the European Parliament and their role. In fact, when we look at the Commission has not been particularly concerned with the cultural, of course, for the most part of its existence. In fact, it was almost exclusively focused for a period of perhaps 30 years or so since its inception in 1957-58 on usually political scientists call output legitimacy, what comes out at the end of the legislative process and whether it is good for the citizens of the European Union and hence increases the legitimacy of political integration and of the European Union. And then about 20 years ago, we see this shift towards also emphasizing, but only under pressure from the contemporary experience of the debate, particularly about the Maastricht Treaty, the negative referendum results, etc., shift towards what political scientists call input legitimacy, the idea that what is perhaps even more important than the output of the legislative process is the democratic quality of the process itself, whatever the actual result of the legislative process might be. And I see for the last 10 years, more particularly for the last 5 years or so, a shift in Commission thinking about legitimacy issues towards cultural legitimacy. And I think this conference and the funding line, if you wish, to some extent, is perhaps also part of this shift towards seeing, you know, an attempt to create greater degree of cultural cohesion across the European Union as a means to create a better and more durable foundation for the European Union also as a political animal and institutional animal. Now, when we look at the European Parliament, which has been much more interested in cultural issues and cultural forms of integration in the past, then the Parliament more recently has become very active in the museum field particularly. You may have heard of the plans for creating a House of European History modelled, you can see this already by, you know, looking at the name, only modelled on the House of the History of the Federal Republic of West Germany in Bonn. And this museum, which is due to open in 2014, would try to present a European version of European history in the 20th century with a particular focus on the post-war period and the experience of European integration. Now, for the moment, it is not yet clear that this will actually finally be funded and come about, and I think there are lots of problems in terms of how to actually tell such a story of European history in the 20th century. I'll come back to that later. But it's also important, I think, to point out that the Brussels-centric view, which much of the political science, sociological and anthropological literature, which looks at the European Union, has taken, is flawed in the cultural field and in the museum field in particular. So we are also looking in the book at the activities of the member states, for which they use the open method of coordination, for example, in creating such cultural commonalities across borders through formation of networks among cultural institutions, etc., and particularly the regions, again something that's particularly important in the northern Italian context as well, which often see regional history and identity and the connection between that level of identity and political integration, institutionalization with the European Union as an effective means to tame the nation state. So regions from Catalonia to Scotland to Baden-Württemberg and southern Tyrol or Trentino, for example, are very active in promoting European cultural cohesion with this particular traditional objective in mind. But it's also important to keep in mind that we shouldn't just look at these state actors. What we are looking at in our book, and which is something that I think is prevalent in the cultural field, not surprisingly perhaps, is that we have a lot of bottom-up intercultural dialogue, which is not always very highly organized and which is not always necessarily financed from the European Union and Brussels, if you wish. And there are lots of different actors that are active here, non-governmental organizations such as museum organizations, for example, but also experts like historians or the actual museum professionals, of course, who work in museums as well as cultural and museum organizations. And what we found overall is that there is a very strong trend towards the Europeanization of these different professional fields and organizational forms across Europe, in the sense that there are more and more institutionalized or informal networks that are being formed, in the sense that these individuals who are active in the museum and cultural field more generally have become more Europeanized in terms of their education and in terms of their professional practice. Even, for example, the French Institut du Patrimoine, which is one of the which is the only Grande École in France, which actually educates museum professionals, now has a compulsory, which is really surprising to anyone who knows how this works in France, historically, now has a compulsory dimension in terms of its professional training, where the French curators will have to spend 3 months abroad at a partner institution to receive their training. So there is a very strong trend towards the Europeanization of these different fields professionally and institutionally. And what plays a very important role in this context, I think, is smaller, micro, and larger macro networks. And these networks, which are not always institutionalized, have a number of important functions, and I'm only listing 3 most important functions here. First of all, they enhance the visibility of museums, in our particular case, and facilitate access to resources, which are spread across this multi-level governance framework of the European Union, across different levels. They're very important for agenda setting and for creating support for new projects, and I'll briefly talk about one particular such micro network in a minute. And they are also crucial as marketplaces for cultural practice, for exchanging ideas about how to do things in museums, what kinds of stories to tell and how to do that, for learning, if you wish, or in managerial bad English, for learning about best practice. We also find that in these networks we have key roles played by cultural, what we call cultural entrepreneurs, who actually propagate particular European ways of doing things in these networks and play key roles as cultural brokers in translating from one cultural and institutional setting to another. The one network that I would very briefly like to mention is the three individuals who have been behind the plan for creating a Museum of European History in Brussels. If you break this down, ultimately, of course, ideas for this had been around already, it boils down to three individuals who also cross different professional divides in terms of their background and their activities. One is, of course, the former president of the European Parliament, Hans-Gerd Pöttering. The other is a politics professor. I'll spare you the details, from the University of Bonn. And the third is the director of the current West German Museum of West German History, the House of History in Bonn. Interestingly, and I think that's characteristic of some of these networks, there's a high degree of cohesion here in terms of their political affiliation, in terms of their views of European integration, which are very federalist, and I could go on about this. And then, of course, this micro-network has been expanded in order to enhance support across the political spectrum in the European Parliament in particular. I would like to move on now and talk a little bit about the different types of narratives of shared European history that we found in museum projects, perhaps more than the existing museums within the member states of the European Union. The first grand narrative, if you like, of the European Union and its history is that of the EU, if you wish, as the end of European history, if to borrow the term that Francis Fukuyama used in his book, published, I think, in 1992, about the end of world history. Here we have a culturalist interpretation of European history, which paradoxically has been largely propagated by French and French-speaking Belgian historians, particularly in the context of plans for so-called Musée de l'Europe to be based in Paris, a kind of alternative to the European Parliament's plan. And here we have an interpretation of European history as one of alternating phases of integration and disintegration. And here, and again, I'm not going to go into the historical details of this, but here we see European integration in the post-war period as a third phase of integration, which appears in the museum context. This organization has actually created an exhibition which was on show in Brussels and then later in Wroclaw in Poland as well, which in the exhibition appears as a kind of final stage of European history, although those who have supported this kind of museum project have argued that, of course, there might be in the future phases of disintegration as well. Importantly, however, this is not based on economic or social forces, but on the idea of cultural forms of integration which may become politicized or institutionalized, as in the case of the European Union. An alternative scenario is this second grand narrative that I've listed here very briefly, of the European Union as the European climax of constitutional patriotism. This is based on the German left liberal idea from the 1960s and 1970s that ethnocentric and nation-centric ways of transnational cooperation are no longer possible or legitimate, or even in the national context, no longer possible or legitimate after Hitler and the Holocaust and the experience of the Second World War. So the original context was an intra-German one, but German actors, again paradoxically, not left liberals but Christian Democrats like Hans-Gerd Pöttering, for example, are trying to transpose this kind of discourse to the European level in the context of the plans for the House of European History. Here the assumption is that naturally in the European context, national or ethnic, ethnicity-based concepts of identity, of integration and cultural integration and shared view of common history are not viable, and therefore we need to find some kind of alternative, and it could be based around the institutionalization of our cooperation in the context of the European Union and the idea of particular collective or individual rights or responsibilities, to refer back to your presentation, in the context of European integration and the EU. Now, none of these grand narratives is to be found for the moment in any particular existing museums, because there is no Museum of European History for the moment. They're basically developed in plans for museums. This is a photo which I just wanted to show you briefly from the exhibition C'est notre histoire. That's our history in the English translation, which Tempora, this Belgian, Brussels-based museum company produced, which was on show in Brussels and then later in Wroclaw in 2009. And you see here, the presentation or the origins of the post-war story, a marginalized Europe. And what you see, and that's really interesting, I'll come back to that later, is a photo, which is difficult for you to see now, but it's a photo of the destroyed city of Cologne, the German city of Cologne, which would have been a possible choice, say Rotterdam or Warsaw or Coventry, for example. I'll come back to that later. This, in turn, is the building, a dental medical center, formerly, in fact, which the European Parliament wants to rebuild and restructure and renovate and then use for the House of European History plan to be based in Brussels. Now, what we find in the existing museums for the moment, which, of course, could be national museums of history, there could be regional museums of history, there could be museums focused on individuals which have something to do with Europe or European integration in the European Union, are three different themes which relate to ways in which we look at European history as shared history, but are not always explicit about telling stories which are European. One is the idea of the European Union's impact on national and regional history, which is now a fairly widespread theme, particularly in some national and regional history museums. This is a photo, for example, from the National History Museum in Copenhagen, where the European Union features very prominently in the context of the referendums which the Danes have had over membership, over the Maastricht Treaty, over the non-adoption in the end of the euro, etc. So in this context, the contestation of how European are we, what kind of Europe do we want, is something that features quite prominently, interestingly, in a country outside of the core Europe area. Or here, very interestingly, I think this is from the National Museum of History in Zurich in Switzerland, which is, of course, not even a member state of the European Union, but where the contestation over Europe and the Swiss membership in the European Economic Area, potentially in the European Union, for example, features quite prominently now at the very end, and where the Swiss curators have deliberately emphasized the internal fragmentation, not just between Switzerland and the rest of Europe, but within Switzerland over these fundamental issues by highlighting the degree to which basically the German-speaking cantons have voted against and the French-speaking and Italian-speaking parts of Switzerland and the cities in favor of closer association with Europe, in inverted commas. Important second theme is the national and regional contributions to European integration, which stands this on its head, if you like. Here is a photo from the exhibition that I've already mentioned, C'est notre histoire, which is about the creation of the coal and steel community in the early 1950s and about the contribution of individual politicians like Robert Schuman here, for example, the French Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, to creating and institutionalizing Europe in the form of the present-day European Union. And here's a photo from Italy, from the Trentino region, the Museo Casa de Gasperi, like museums for Monet or for Schumann or for Adenauer that exist, also begin to Europeanize. Originally, they are basically museums about a regional politician who becomes a national leader, and now they become much more concerned with telling European stories about these regional and national leaders, such as the Gasperi here, for example, in this museum, or in this particular museum, which is actually owned by the European Parliament, Jean Monnet, the Jean Monnet House, which is near Paris. A third theme, which I want to just mention very briefly, is the integration experiences of ordinary citizens. I think what museums find is there are great problems with the different ways in which museums try to highlight the role of particular well-known individuals, the so-called founding fathers. I've mentioned some of them. I can't go into the details of this, but for the museums, this presents various problems in terms of the representation of European history. And what they are moving towards is towards a situation where they want to narrate the individual experiences of citizens of the European Union of a transnational kind that can be linked to European Union politics in some way, in the post-war period. So we see this in C'est Notre Histoire, we see this now in the visitor center of the European Parliament, which has just been opened in Brussels, for example, where the stories of somewhere in the region, it's not one per member state, I think it's a larger number of individuals who've been interviewed across the European Union. They talk about their individual lives, which have some kind of transnational European core dimension. And then the European Parliament has chosen the option of then explaining at the end, after the interviews, how the European Parliament thinks that these individual experiences of these citizens are linked to or have been facilitated by certain fundamental treaty changes or legislative changes in the European Union context. And this is something that we see in different forms coming up more and more in existing museums in Europe. Now, my final point is briefly to link this brief introduction to Europe and European Union history, particularly in museums, to what Legevie has called the European memory battle. Museums, alongside other cultural institutions and social contexts, obviously, are sites for contestation of individual as well as collective memory, and I think it's very important to highlight once more that this memory is, of course, even within nation states, in particular in nation states like Italy, for example, or Germany, very highly fragmented. So we should not start from the assumption that there is any kind of cohesive national collective memory in the first instance, although I still find this idea of thinking about this in the literature and in public debates very much. Now, do we observe, in terms of what the museums are doing, a convergence or beginning convergence of European collective memory to a very limited extent? What we have found is that museums tell more and more transnational stories about trade, about migration, about intercultural exchanges, which basically reflect the fact that younger generations of Europeans, but also to some extent in other parts of the world, experience their world as much less confined by their local, regional, or national context, and as transgressing national boundaries, and perhaps even to some extent regional, global boundaries as well. But this, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that these transnational stories always become linked to the experience of Europe, the European Union, and European integration in the EU context. Also, if they do contribute, and they at least have the potential to contribute to increasing what might be called the European cultural, civilizational identity, then that does not necessarily translate into an enhanced or increased political identity of these individual visitors to museums as citizens of the European Union, which is, of course, ultimately what the institutions in Brussels really want. So I have some question marks in terms of what we found out in our research projects about these expectations. What I think is really important, however, is to keep in mind that we have had for the last 15 or 20 years or so a concentration in terms of this memory battle on negative memory discourses about collective negative historical experiences such as the Holocaust or the World Wars, for example. And this, I think, is highly problematic in terms of enhancing, which appears to be the objective here, of course, a greater commonality in the ways in which we think about our past. And there need to be, I think, some positive reference points in our history as well, not just negative ones to which we as Europeans can relate collectively. And the history of European integration in the post-war period is, as far as I can see, the only one positive experience that is to some extent shared, although there are great differences from core Europe to recently acceded member states, of course, and cultural differences within Europe on this point as well. But it's something that, therefore, of necessity, somehow needs to be integrated in this emerging European collective memory. But at the same time, that's my concluding point, what I see mainly in terms of the political battle of ideas over collective European memory at the moment is a very strong push with a lot of resources, particularly not money but time, invested into this by the new member states from East Central Europe, particularly countries like Poland in the European Union context. And we see that reflected in debates and resolutions in the European Parliament for the what I would call the totalitarian paradigm. And this is to focus very strongly on our experience as Europeans in the national and transnational context as victims of the totalitarian ideologies and political systems of the 20th century on an equal level National Socialism and Fascism, as well as the Stalinist regimes of the post-war and communist regimes of the post-war period in Eastern Europe. And the problematic thing about this, I think, in essence, is that in this kind of discourse, we completely lose sight of the fact that we Europeans, and some more than others, obviously, have also been perpetrators in these crimes as well. So when you look at some existing museums like the House of Terror in Budapest, for example, you get the impression that if Hungarians have only suffered in the 20th century, the fascist and communists who worked for the Hungarian dictatorship during the Second World War and after the Second World War as perpetrators do not feature in the museum. And I think I'm really concerned about this kind of tendency, which is reflected to some extent, for example, in Sinotristwach, where you have the city of Cologne, and where Germans only feature as those who have also suffered during the Second World War, which they have also done, you know, but the perpetrators are completely written out of the story. So my fear is that if this evolves in this direction, we'll end up with a very convenient but very unhealthy integration and the creation of a new memory paradigm across Europe, which combines the idea of collective victimhood of Europeans during the 20th century, having suffered under some kind of very abstract totalitarian systems, which didn't have any real visible perpetrators, on the one hand, and the heroic reconstruction and integration narrative, which is, of course, something that the European Union wants to propagate and is propagating very strongly. Thank you.